Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Friday, March 1st, 2019. Amnesty International says authorities in South Sudan have hanged a lot of people to death.
Regardless of what they are accused of, it is unacceptable to use the death penalty because it actually does not prevent future crimes, and it's very final if you were to conduct, if any evidence were to come up.
And Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir has appointed the former leader of Janjaweed to lead his party.
And now, when you come to the political side in his own party, he beat Ahmed Haroon, the kind of excuse here that he wants to be at the same distance with all political forces.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Amnesty International says many executions occurred in South Sudan last month. The London-based rights group say authorities executed at least seven people in February. Amnesty's deputy director for East Africa is calling on authorities to enact a moratorium on executions and take steps to abolish death penalty. Onan Walter Solomon reports for VOA from Juba.
That is something that we condemn in the strongest terms, because use of the death penalty is totally unacceptable. They should not be executing people in secrecy without even letting their families know. That is not how they should be handling matters of justice.
That is Sheikh Magango, Amnesty International's Deputy Director for East Africa, the Horn and Great Lakes, who is calling on the government of South Sudan to enact a moratorium on the death penalty, like many other countries have done. South Sudan's Penal Code Act 2008 provides execution by hanging for murder or bearing false witness, resulting in an innocent person's execution. The death penalty is also allowed for terrorism, banditry, insurgency, or sabotage activities resulting in death. It allows a person to be executed for aggravated drug trafficking and treason. Speaking to South Sudan in Focus from Nairobi, Magango says Amnesty International opposes the death penalty in all cases without exception, regardless of the nature of the crime.
Regardless of what they are accused of, it is unacceptable to use the death penalty because it actually does not prevent future crimes, and it's very final. If you were to conduct, if any evidence were to come up later on to show that these individuals were innocent and were convicted by mistake, their lives have already been taken.
And Magango says South Sudan should immediately commute all death sentences to terms of imprisonment.
And that's why we are calling on the South Sudan government to aim to be part of the countries that are moving in the right direction to stop this state-sanctioned execution of its citizens. They can still punish people through use of prison terms up to life in prison.
Magango says since there are other reversible forms of punishment, including life imprisonment, means authorities have alternatives for punishing people instead of executing them. South Sudan Cabinet Affairs Minister Martin Elialumoro confirms the government still uses the death penalty under existing law, but indicated that could change.
Establishment or changing laws is a process. We are currently in the process of building a country. This country has not been built yet because its process of building has been interrupted by this internal conflict. So laws which do not conform to the aspirations of international organizations will be studied and looked at as the country establishes its permanent constitution and relevant laws.
Lumoro notes the Commission for Healing, Truth and Reconciliation was established to play a crucial role in determining how perpetrators of crimes will be punished.
That commission is supposed to not only reconcile people after the conflict, but also to be able to address issues where somebody has been murdered by a certain person and people can choose to forgive themselves by, first of all, those who committed the crimes have to accept that they committed the crime, and they call for apology.
Iran, Saudi Arabia, and China still have the death penalty, but many other countries have abolished it. Capital punishment is a legal penalty in the United States. It is used by 30 states, the federal government, and the military. For VOA News, I am Onan Walter Solomon in Juba.
Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir has appointed Ahmed Haroun to be the leader of the National Congress Party. Hamdi Abdelrahman, a professor of political science at Zayed University in Dubai, says Bashir wants to hand over power to someone who will not hand him over to the International Criminal Court. Abdelrahman says the international community is interested in Sudan's stability, and any changes in Bashir's party is seen as good news. But he says the new leader of the ruling National Congress Party is also on the ICC list.
What he did lately, he came back to the main source of his support, the military and the security, sector. Because I think since he came to power, he was able to use co-option and to bring the loyal people to his side. Finally, he picked his successor when he appointed the Minister of Defense, Ben Auf, as first vice president. And now, when you come to the political side, in his party, his own party, he picked Ahmed Haroun, the kind of excuse here that he wants to be at the same distance with all the political forces and, parties. But I think he's biased to the military, and if there is something wrong, and if the heat of this opposition at the street continues, he at least will have, his close friends will succeed him.
Let's look at Ahmed Haroun. How influential is he? Who is he?
He used to be the governor of Darfur. These people, they have the same threat of the ICC. He wants not to be alone, because the ICC factor is very important looking at the future of Mr. Bashir. He wants to stick in power in order to save his neck from the threat of the International Criminal Court. This is one of his strategies. So Ahmed Haroun, yes, the big guy of Darfur, he has a history of the Janjaweed militia, and his successor now is the leader of the Janjaweed, Hamidati, General Hamidati, which is now became part of the military institution. We call it the rabbit, forces.
How about the other political forces in the country, like the Popular Congress Party, Sadiq al-Mahdi's party, and the other opposition? What is their contribution to this stalemate in Sudan, if you like, political stalemate?
You know, now the Islamists are the major and the main force in Sudan, whether you have some of them trying to make a nice opposition or to be benign to the regime, but the Islamists are very important. And, since the military have this alliance with them, al-Bashir and al-Turabi, and the main ideology of the regime itself is a kind of Islamization of Sudan, and still the narrative, the dominant narrative, is Islamic. So this is one of the main political forces. And then you have the traditional forces. You have the Al-Ansar, Sadiq al-Mahdi, and his the Sufi, and they have the roots in Sudan. But those in the street who are making, you know, they are rising, are the new forces. They are not engaged in the traditional political organization or even these Sufis order. They are, you know, university students, professionals, and this is why you have the professional leading the uprising now.
Analysts in the region, in the Arab world, in the Middle East, and even in East Africa, who have been saying that it appears like Bashir is counting his last days. Do you subscribe to that school of thought?
If you compare what is going on in Sudan as the 2011 Arab uprising, no, there is a big difference. The regional and international situation was totally different. Now, if you look at the regional factors, you don't want another chaos. They don't want another Libya. So they do care about what comes next after al-Bashir. We don't need another failed state. We have suffered a lot from South Sudan, and we have the continued crisis in Libya. So many countries, international forces, they do care about security more than the demand, the popular demand of the people. So they want to combine all of these together.
That's Hamdi Abdulrahman, professor of political science at Zayed University in Dubai. He was speaking to me from Dubai earlier today. South Sudan has lost the chance to lead the Nile Basin Initiative because it failed to pay annual membership dues of more than $1 million to the body. As Wake Simon Wudu reports for VOA from Juba, one expert on natural resource management says South Sudan will be viewed as a failed state because of its incapable of meeting its obligation.
The Nile Basin Initiative, or NBI, is an intergovernmental partnership of 10 Nile Basin countries: Burundi, DR Congo, Egypt, Ethiopia, Kenya, Rwanda, Sudan, Tanzania, Uganda, and South Sudan. The NBI was established in 1999 to manage and develop water resources from the Nile River in a cooperative manner and promote regional peace. The executive director position is rotated among the 10 member states. Francis Waju, South Sudan's director for water resources, management regulations in the Water Resources Ministry, and the country's liaison at the NBI Technical Advisory Committee, blames South Sudan's conflict for the government's failure to pay its NBI dues last year.
The first 3 years, I think we were able to pay. But now we couldn't pay. The last, I think it is because of the war that has affected the economy, such that contributions were not coming. But it is in our plan that we are planning, and we are making some options to make sure that we also pay, because it is very important as a member to contribute so that the organization is sustainable.
In September, an official engineer, Thomas Jeng, with the South Sudan Ministry of Water Resources, told South Sudan in Focus that Juba owed at least $2 million to the NBI. Waju says South Sudan will not protest NBI's move to have Sudan choose the next executive director.
In the presence of the NILCO member of South Sudan, realize the seriousness of the contribution, because the ID is paid out of the country contribution. So the NILCOM agree that since a country, any country that has failed to pay, of course will not take. That is a decision of the NILCOM.
Nial Tete Mamere, Program Director for Environment and Natural Resource at the Juba-based Soot Institute, says despite the country's economic challenges, South Sudan has no excuse for failing to pay its NBI membership dues.
South Sudan will be seen as a failed country that does not meet its obligation, international obligations, in other words. But also, South Sudan internally will be affected in the sense even the citizens themselves will see as having been failed or having failed. themselves by not meeting the obligation of their government.
Tite Mamer says the incident robs South Sudan of having equal status with the other member states.
South Sudan will not speak at equal level at the table because the Nile Basin Initiative is a forum of countries where people can speak on equal terms. And now that we are failing to live to that level of equality, it is going to affect our ability to be able to articulate the issues of Nile waters at this forum.
And Tite Mamer says South Sudan will miss other important opportunities that will impact to the country.
If a South Sudanese was given this role, this person could have shaped the agenda in a way that will result into some benefits for South Sudanese. Initiating projects, hydro projects or irrigation projects, and so on and so forth, that can be collectively refinanced through this initiative. So this way, but now the opportunity has gone to a different country, and this person is going to shape the agenda in a different way.
Rwandan engineer Innocent Tabana, the outgoing NBA executive director, says he cannot divulge exactly how much money South Sudan is in arrears with the NBI, but says the decision to move on and allow Sudan to pick the next executive director ensures NBI's sustainability.
We have reached a situation now where we have to make a choice. Either we support the institution to continue and we'll let it die. And nobody would like to see NBI dying.
South Sudan joined the NBI in 2012. Last Friday, the institution celebrated its 20th anniversary in the Rwandan capital, Kigali, under the theme NBI at 20th, Stronger Together. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, people living with HIV/AIDS say discrimination is common in South Sudan. That story is coming up after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how do you react when you fail?
I just take it easy and I pray for my chance to come again. I calm down my heart.
Well, I feel I'm down, but it gives me the strength to work harder or to get another enterprise. If I fail in some line, I achieve that one, then I look for another opportunity.
Not so bad, but I take it as a stepping stone to something bigger. So I don't cry. However, I don't rejoice as much. I just relax and then think of where I made the mistakes and other things and then push myself up.
People don't enjoy failure, but it all helps and motivates and keeps me going, because if I fail, I learn a lot from that and I don't want to repeat that. So anytime I fail, I realize and I go back and correct the mistake that I did.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. On this International Zero Discrimination Day, people in South Sudan living with HIV/AIDS say they often experience several forms of discrimination at work and at home. They say they are discriminated against even at health facilities, which makes it harder for them to access health care. Some HIV-positive citizens are calling on politicians to enact a law that ensures protection for all people living with HIV and AIDS. Winnie Chirino has more for VOA from Juba.
Senior South Sudan Army officer Grace Paul says she has lived with HIV for the past 13 years. Paul says her three children and husband are safe. She says during the Liberation War, SPLM founding leader John Garang used to warn soldiers to be careful about their sexual relationships to avoid contracting HIV/AIDS, but she says that advice pretty much fell on deaf ears. Paul says in 2006, a few institutions in the area provided HIV/AIDS services and she would regularly travel to Arua in northern Uganda to receive her medicine. Speaking in Arabic, Paul says even though she did everything she could to treat the disease and protect others, people would still discriminate against her.
Many people talk like my neighbors, say that my child should not play with other children in the residential area because the child is born by a mother who is HIV positive and the child has HIV. But when they talk like that, I go to the chief head of the area and we talk about the issue so that they don't abuse again.
Another person living with HIV virus who prefers to be identified only as Mary to protect her privacy says she learned she was HIV positive in 2011 when her parents took her to see a doctor. Before she tested positive, Mary says her husband used to store antiretroviral drugs in the house, but she didn't know the medicine was for HIV/AIDS because the writing on the bottles were in English, which she could not read. Mary says when health officials gave her the same medicine her husband took every day, she realized she was infected by her husband. Mary bakes and sells pancakes to earn a living in Juba, but she says her competitors often advise would-be customers not to buy from her, telling them made-up stories like Mary injects her infected blood into the pancakes. She says people in the hospital are not much better.
Anna, what eyes?
I am living with HIV virus, but what pains me so much is that there are people in the hospital, and when they come to the community, they will point out to others that look at that girl going, or that woman, she is HIV positive. And this is not good. There are people who die because once they are identified like that, they become more stigmatized. And sometimes they refuse to take drugs and die easily.
Another person living with the HIV virus who prefers to be identified only as Betty says she too has been discriminated against. Betty says some people refuse to use caps and plates she has used for fear they will contract HIV. She advises people living with HIV to attend counseling so that they can deal with the discrimination and stigma.
I'm faithful for my drugs and for my job. So once I'm being finger pointed, as for 9 days, I don't think of anything. I first led me, even I'm now even counseling my colleagues in any way. I'm making home visit as well to them and encouraging them for everything.
Sarah Bejer, coordinator for the Network of AIDS Services Organization in South Sudan, an umbrella organization of NGOs addressing HIV and AIDS in South Sudan, says she has witnessed several forms of discrimination against people living with HIV. Abidjan urges healthcare workers and government officials to provide equal services to people regardless of their HIV status.
Ensure that laws are implemented in order to reduce discriminatory practices and change so that everyone has access to health care services regardless of who they are. We also call upon the authorities to stop using stigmatizing language when referring to HIV, sexual and reproductive health, and related social issues.
Sophia Mokasa, country director for UNAIDS in South Sudan, says there are more than 180,000 people living with the HIV virus in South Sudan. Among them, 35,000 are accessing treatment. She says the UNAIDS target is that 90% of people living with HIV know their status. Right now, she says only 25% are tested in the country.
We are working with the health system strengthening partners to ensure that there is no stigma in the health facilities as well as discrimination. We are talking about workplace policies so that we protect people living with HIV from being discriminated as far as employment is concerned.
Michelle Sidibe, executive director of UNAIDS, says in a statement released today that human rights violations are happening all over the world because of discriminatory laws and practices. He says the laws must protect, not cause harm. And Sidibe is calling on all countries to carefully examine their laws and policies to ensure equality and protection for all people without exception. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
Malawian President Peter Mutharika has offered a 5 million kwacha reward for information leading to the arrest and persecution of anyone scheming to abduct albinos. Albinos are being murdered in Malawi for ritualistic purposes. It is believed their body parts bring magical powers. Mutharika said his government gave 3,000 personal security alarms to people with albinism and established a commission to look into attacks on albinos. This comes ahead of Malawi's presidential election May 21st. Lazarus Chakwera, presidential candidate with the Malawi Congress Party, tells my colleague James Batty that Malawians are not satisfied with empty promises.
First of all, I am happy that he has released a statement to the end that everything I stated demanding that he take action has been adopted. And then on top of that, he has stated that he would have the 5 million kwacha given anybody who would lead to successful prosecution of those suspects. Now, he needs to know that we already have people in prison arrested as suspects over this issue. We already have so many files, and it was reported in the House of Parliament that they would follow up on those files, and nothing has happened. So we will not be satisfied with just promises. We will need to see real action. And real action means let them begin prosecuting those who are already in custody, rather than to offer such empty promises that seem to me sounding more like tokenism.
According to one account I read, since 2014, there have been 150 cases involving people with albinism. So yes. Do you think with Malawi going to a presidential election on May 21st, do you think every presidential candidate should come out to say something about what to do about this problem?
Well, I believe they ought to do that. I broke the silence over the issue because it was becoming increasingly something that just breaks your heart when you see a whole segment of Malawians who need protection just like everybody else being mistreated in this fashion and being hunted and killed in this fashion for whatever reason. I know there's a United Nations report that said many politicians, for whatever reason, superstition, or they think they can gain some power so they can get elected or reelected. Whatever it is something that is the devil, it's satanic, it's evil. Whatever the market is, we have to break that syndicate.
That's Lazarus Chakwera, presidential candidate with the Malawian Congress Party, speaking to VOA's James Batty. That brings us to the end of our show for this Friday, when I leave you with Kang JJ singing in his native Nuer language. We've been listening to Kang JJ singing in his native Nuer language. Unfortunately, my Nuer is very rusty. I don't know what he's singing about. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. If you would like to share a comment or something or you hear about on this show, you can find us on the Twitter. Our handle is @VOA South Sudan. If you're planning to be out of Juba where there are no FM stations, you can still listen to us on shortwave. Our frequencies are 11850 kilohertz, 13865 kilohertz, and 15180 kilohertz. We hope you have a safe weekend. Join us again on Monday for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.